Yeah, now it's all good. Excuse me. David, would you do me a favor and run into the kitchen, grab me a bottle of water across? It's right across from the fridge. Thank you. I'm still not 100%. Have you ever made this statement, this wasn't the way it was supposed to be? I remember clearly as perhaps I ever have, you are a scholar and a gentleman. I won't. I mean, it's now on the record officially, but that was also really fast. I'm impressed. He is fast. I've had the thought this wasn't how it was supposed to be on several occasions, because life often doesn't look the way we anticipated it. I've learned a lot in my life about planning, and I'm one that likes to plan. It is not in my nature to plan, but I've forced myself by just by force of habit, by the position that I'm in, to try to plan. But the more I plan, the more often I find that plans don't always line up with the way that you expect, the way that maybe you hope. And the problem that I have found in my life is that when things don't turn out the way I want, I find myself often crumbling. When God works things out differently than I had hoped, I find myself losing hope, or I find myself becoming afraid and trying to hold on for dear life to whatever I can to maintain some kind of illusion of control. Because here's a thing that we don't often like to admit to ourselves, let alone in a room full of people. I don't like losing control. It's why I budget months in advance in my own life, because I want to know where my finances will be, not just tomorrow, but I want to know where I'm going to be in March. I like to have a plan, and I don't like when my budget doesn't line up with my expectations. Now, I've been told it's best to call it a financial plan because things change. But I don't like that. I want to be in control. And maybe you know what that's like all too well. Maybe you have been there, because many of us don't feel like we're in control. Most of us don't feel like things are going the way that we want it. One of the interesting elements of my life has been the fact that I didn't want to be a pastor. Believe it or not, this was not the job that I wanted. Ask 8-year-old me. I actually dreamt of being a pastor for like a minute when I was 8. It was weird. It's a whole story. You know, normal kids are dreaming of things like being an astronaut or being a firefighter, or being something cool. I dreamt of being a pastor for a hot minute. Now, having the knowledge that comes with age and the wisdom that comes with it, I think God was trying to tell me something even at a young age. But I knew, even as a teenager, that being a pastor meant giving up certain things that I didn't want to give up. I knew that being a pastor would be something that I would have to choose a life that was different than the life I would prefer to live. Now, thank God not all of us are called to be pastors, but what I have found is that God often will call us to a life that looks differently than we expect. And many of you have probably lived long enough to recognize that there are areas of your life that God is not allowing to stay with the status quo. And sometimes we do what I did, especially as a teenager, and we try to either deny what God is telling us, or we deny God entirely. And we try to ignore him or ignore his word, ignore his call. And in the world we live in, it's easier than ever to fill our lives with distractions. We've talked about that multiple times over the last couple of months and the ease of distraction in our culture. But what I've found in my own life is that God rarely allows us to ignore him indefinitely. And in my life, I came to a point where I had to make a choice. Would I follow where God was leading me, or would I insist on things being the way that I wanted? Because the life I envisioned for myself, I think, was romanticized. I had a couple of ideas in mind, one of which was to follow in my father and his whole family's footstep and go into probably the tech sector of business management. And let's be real, I wanted to make lots of money, copious amounts of money. And I was convinced that I could. I was convinced I was born in the right time to really get on that train that was taking off. I graduated from high school 2 months before the iPhone was first introduced. I mean, it would have been a rocket to success. But as people who have been in business, I don't. Whenever I say in business, I think of you. Have you seen Muppet Christmas Carol? Uncle Sam, you'll love business. Rabbit trail. But as you'll find, that life often doesn't go the way you planned, even when you have the life that you wanted. My father, God bless him, I don't know many people that are more resilient than he is, because he went into business, he pursued what he wanted to do, and he even got into the tech sector that I thought I'd get into, and I've never seen somebody experience the lows that he has just professionally. Now, he has experienced some great highs, but life doesn't turn out the way you'd expect. And so for me, I knew that I had to make a choice. And it wasn't a choice between me being in control, because control is an illusion. I know that now. I didn't know that as a 19-year-old. Rarely as a 19-year-old is your head screwed on straight. I think that's biological, actually. I think that's like scientifically proven. You're awful dumb as a 19-year-old. But I found that even the illusion of control had the ability to derail where God was leading me. And maybe you like being in control too, or at least you like the illusion of being in control. Maybe it's a struggle at work. Perhaps your work environment is chaotic and stressful, and you look around and you say, if everyone would just do things my way, everything would be fine, Warren. I love you, brother. I saw you poking your wife. You've said that to me. You've literally said that sentence to me. But it may not be like that. I'm not calling Warren out for anything that is not all love. It's all love. But maybe what you think instead of your coworkers is you look at your boss and you think, man, if he knew what he was doing, don't laugh so loud, then everything would be okay. Or maybe you're the boss and you think if everyone would actually do what you told them, the company would run so much better. Or maybe it's at home. Maybe you are the kind of person that has the mantra, a place for everything, and everything in its place. For you, you get physically uncomfortable when things aren't where they're supposed to be. Or maybe you demand certain things from your family, certain behaviors, certain attitudes, and you micromanage to the point of you even may admit ridiculousness so that you can maintain some level of control. Or maybe it's just with people. Sometimes we get into this place where we believe that we can control others because maybe we feel like we can't control ourselves. We want to try to even perhaps manipulate others to act and live a certain way. Sometimes we're so committed to controlling others that we resort to threats. But we all know that this urge to control is illusory. It is not real. It is a fleeting high. It is something that you can grasp, but it's like sand in an hourglass, and it just falls. And you know that as you feel less in control, the more driven you are to try to control what you can. And as we continue in this series called Christmas Ruins Everything, we are challenged and I hope inspired to re-examine our lives in the light of the story of the birth and life of Jesus. It's kind of a big deal. But for a lot of us, it's interesting. When we think of the Christmas story, we think often of Luke 2. Luke 2 is the story of Mary and Joseph coming to Bethlehem. There's no room in the inn. They go to the stable. They have the baby. It's in the manger, the shepherds, the angels. That's the story. But for this week and next week, I feel quite compelled to look outside of that story to see the life-transforming good news of great joy in the lives of people that are often overlooked in the story of that first Christmas. Because though we talk a lot about the mother of Jesus, very rarely do we talk about his stepfather, his earthly guardian, his mentor, and his protector, and his provider. And in the story of Joseph, I think we find that Christmas ruins control. Joseph's story is found in Matthew chapter 1, if you want to look there with me. It's a story that's easy to miss because as you look in Matthew chapter 1, you're going to see a lot of names listed. And unless you're a historian or a genealogy kind of buff that you like knowing family histories and the intricacies that come with it, you probably skip Matthew 1, 1 through 17. In fact, you may skip Matthew 1 altogether without realizing that when you skip Matthew chapter 1, you miss a beautiful, powerful, challenging piece of scripture. Joseph, his life, his family history is given to us from beginning with Abraham, the founder of the people of Israel, through their most famous king named David. The family history is given through the exile of the people of God into Babylon, which is a whole story that I'm not going to dive into too much, but needless to say, the people of God were held captive in a foreign land. And then we go from the exile to this man named Joseph. And we don't know a lot about Joseph. We know one or two things. We know first that he is a carpenter, and second that he was engaged. It is likely, given our understanding of first century life, that Joseph was not much older than Mary, perhaps somewhat older, but not by much. We're talking he may have been a late teenager, maybe early 20s. It was expected that at this point, a man would get married. And Matthew 1:18 begins by telling us of their situation. It says this, Matthew writes, "This is how Jesus the Messiah was born. His mother Mary was engaged to be married to Joseph." Now, a couple of things we got to just nail down real quick before we keep going, because we got to understand what this means. Because when somebody tells you that they're engaged today, it means something different than if somebody told you they were engaged in the first century Middle East. In today's world, if you are engaged, it is a non-binding agreement in the sense of you exchange a ring, typically. The man will give the fiancé a ring, and typically speaking, they'll make plans to get married, typically speaking, unless you're watching a Hallmark movie, in which case the protagonist about 80% of the time is engaged to be married to some big city, cold-hearted businessman. But they never set a date. He refuses to set a date. He's very, very, overplayed. But in the case of a separation, the ending of a relationship, the end was just a matter of a mutual agreement or one person saying it's over. But in Jesus' day, in the first century, engagement was something much more meaningful, both from a personal level and from a legal perspective. In first century Israel, when you were engaged to be married, there was a legal contract drawn up and signed not just by the betrothed, but by their parents. There was a gift given from the husband-to-be to the wife-to-be, as well as from the husband to the wife's parents, and interestingly enough, the wife's-to-be's parents would also give a gift to their children to invest in their future. The only way to end an engagement in first century Israel was divorce. You were, by all accounts, tied to one another till death. The second thing that's important to remember here is that in first century Israel, as it is in much of the Far East today, their marriage would have been arranged. Now, that's something that makes us wildly uncomfortable in the West. We do not like the concept because we, of course, consider marriage to be something that blossoms out of romance. But in their culture, marriage was more about survival and success, of creating a legacy and to continue your family name. It was not really much about the romance. In fact, in some cultures, the bride and groom wouldn't meet until their wedding day, though this doesn't seem to be the case in first century Israel. But Joseph is engaged to be married to Mary. And in this betrothal stage, they would likely have gotten to get to know each other. They're from a small town called Nazareth in a small province called Galilee. It's likely that they knew of each other, if not know each other. And an arranged marriage does not prohibit romantic love. So there's a good chance that Joseph was attempting to not just get to know Mary, but to woo her. In fact, at this point in his life, Joseph probably had dreams too. Joseph probably had the dreams that most of us would have of marrying this woman and settling down, building a home, and building a life together. Having children, teaching them, having a son and teaching him to play hockey and to teach him, no, that's my dream, never mind, to teach him how to play whatever the first century Israelite version of hockey would have been, to build a house, to teach his son the trade that he was taught by his father, and to create a legacy with his family. I don't know what his dreams looked like, but for Joseph at this point, all was well. Joseph had Mary, and the world was good. But we find in the second part of Matthew chapter 1, Matthew tells us that before they could be married, while she was still a virgin, she became pregnant through the power of the Holy Spirit. Now, Matthew has the benefit of knowing the whole story. But it would appear that Joseph did not. If you're familiar with the story in the book of Luke, you know that's exactly how it happened. According to Mary herself, she didn't understand how she could possibly become pregnant. She had never been sexually intimate with anybody, let alone her betrothed. But the angel told her this would be an act of God, that she was chosen because she had never entered into that relationship. But we find in verse 19 that this story clearly didn't sit well with Joseph. We don't get told what went through his mind, but Matthew does tell us that Joseph didn't believe her. In verse 19, he writes, "Joseph, to whom she was engaged, was a righteous man and did not want to disgrace her publicly, so he decided to break the engagement quietly." And the Greek here literally means he decided to divorce her quietly. He was ready and willing to end the whole thing. Now, when you know how the story ends, you may think that he judged harshly and swiftly. But I think before we go down that road too far, we need to stop and consider his mind state. Use your mind's eye to put yourself in his shoes. This wasn't the way it was supposed to be. Your fiance returns from 3 months visiting her cousin and she's visibly pregnant. And you know it ain't yours. And I don't know if you've ever had the moment of panic where you felt like your world was crashing down around you. I know it wasn't this for me, but I know many of us, we can think of that moment. We can crystallize it in our minds. It may be a phone call we received. It may be in a doctor's office when we were given a diagnosis or when your boss called you in to their office. It may be getting a test or a paper back. Or maybe a simple text saying it's over. And suddenly everything you knew to be true, everything you knew to be secure, everything you knew to be right was falling, crumbling at your feet. Maybe you've had a spouse or a partner be unfaithful to you and you can put yourself into Joseph's shoes pretty easily. Imagine the conversation with Mary as she passionately, desperately begs Joseph to believe her. As she tells her story of the angel and the Holy Spirit and the conception and the promise. And through tears, imagine her pleading with Joseph, begging him to trust that her story was true, that she had not been unfaithful to him. Imagine his mind racing, trying to make sense of the ridiculous story that this woman was telling him. Picture him walking out of the room stone-faced. Don't let her see you cry, Joe. This was it. The life that he had built in his mind was over. He had likely begun to work on the house that they would live in. Historically, this would have been either attached to his parents' home or on their property. What was he going to tell them? What would he tell anybody? He couldn't possibly believe her. The story is literally insane. She's either a liar or a lunatic. There's no other options. What kind of liar makes up a story like that? But all he knows is she's pregnant and he's not the father. This wasn't the way it was supposed to be. So Joseph does the only thing he knows is right and he decides to end the engagement. But the scriptures say he was a righteous man. And though he was entitled to publicly shame Mary, though he was entitled to dole out punishment on Mary for her unfaithfulness, decides instead to do it privately and quietly. He could not marry her. The law forbid it, and he believed his God forbid it. So he did the only thing he knew to be right and good and honorable. But this wasn't the way it was supposed to be. Maybe you're feeling that all too well today. Maybe you're feeling like Joseph, that you feel as though your life has been hit by a hurricane of disaster and you feel like you don't know where to turn. Perhaps you're in the position of Joseph where you don't even know who to believe or who to trust, but you know that life feels like it's over. Your plans, your dreams, your desires feel like they evaporated like the fog on a summer's morning. Maybe you're crying to God because you don't know what to do. One of the most oft-quoted verses in the Jewish scriptures, what we call the Old Testament, is found in Proverbs 3. It's one of those pithy-sounding quotes that you'll often find stylized on people's Instagram feed. It's on coffee mugs and throw pillows. But it's one that is really hard to grab onto when you're in the middle of a Joseph situation. It says this, it says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways submit to God and he will make your paths straight." I don't know about you, but when life is feeling like it's slipping through my fingers, when I feel like the foundation of my life has cracked and crumbled, submitting my ways to God is a lot harder than it seems. Because when life is crumbling around you, our inclination is to grab anything we can and hold it tight, and to clench as tight as we can to the things we can control. And what I have found is in the season like Joseph is experiencing and like I've experienced and perhaps you are experiencing is that trusting in God completely often requires more than I'm willing to give up. And when God calls us to trust him, even with the things to which we hold so tightly, we back away because it feels like it's too much to ask. And we cling with clenched fists. The more we try to control, the more afraid we are of losing control. And the more we fear losing control, the harder we grasp onto it. It's a vicious cycle of fear and control. But God speaks into Joseph's life. And he tells Joseph that his story isn't over. In fact, Matthew writes, "As he considered the divorce, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream. Joseph, son of David," the angel said, "do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for the child within her was conceived by the Holy Spirit, and she will have a son, and you will name him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins." And all of this occurred to fulfill the Lord's message through his prophet, saying, "Look, the virgin will conceive a child. She will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel," which means God is with us. There you have it, you might be thinking. He heard from God. That answers it, right? I mean, everything has got to be okay now. God spoke. Joseph heard him. Now he's just going to obey, right? And if you keep reading, yes. Yes, that's exactly what he does. But I think before we jump too far, we have to remember something important. Even in his newfound revelation, Joseph still has a life-defining choice to make. Life was about to get a whole lot more complicated than he had ever imagined. Joseph had to choose. Would he follow through on his plans to divorce his betrothed so he could find a nice, simple, uncomplicated girl and settle down and build the life that he dreamt of? Or would he listen to the words of the angel and marry Mary? Because let me tell you, when the angel said, "Do not be afraid," there was a lot for Joseph to be afraid for. Mary was still an unwed pregnant girl in a culture where that could get you shunned or killed. Joseph, even if he would marry her, would have to do what? Pretend to be the child's father? Accept the judgmental stares and whispers from the people in his community? I mean, who would believe his story after all? Even with the knowledge he knew now, nobody would possibly believe him. What would his life even look like now? How could he make a living in a small community where everyone knows your business? He was a carpenter. People had to hire him. Who would hire the man that married the woman that was clearly unfaithful? And what's he going to do with this child? How do you raise the Son of God? I'm just a carpenter. I'm a nobody. How do I raise God's child? Joseph was faced with a terrifying decision. One that he must not have taken lightly. Would he choose to trust God's plan, or would he choose his own path? Would he choose control, or would he choose surrender? You know, Joseph received a word that God was writing him a new story. One that differed wildly from the one he created in his mind. It didn't make sense. It was almost in every way unbelievable, because even in the first century, they knew that certain things had to happen to create life. But he was still being asked to trust that all of this was part of God's story that he was writing. And God asked him to trust that God was doing what he said he would do, asking Joseph to reject centuries of tradition and technically break with religious law to marry this woman. And even though he couldn't possibly understand it, even though he couldn't possibly wrap his mind around what all was happening, Joseph chose to trust that God had a purpose. Now, some of us will joke. We'll say, you know, I wish an angel would just materialize for me. I wish that I could get a word from the Lord. I wish the heavens would open up and you'd hear an audible voice booming, just so I can be certain. If we just heard that voice from heaven, we'd be convinced. But you know, I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if we'd hear that voice and just assume that we were hallucinating. If we'd have the dream like Joseph and just assume that it was just an undigested bit of beef or a blob of mustard or a crumb of cheese, fragment of an underdone potato. But the challenge for us is that the statement that defined Joseph in the sentence before that said that he was a righteous man. Joseph heard from God in an unlikely way only after he'd committed to living out God's will for him. We often long for the clouds to open up and a scroll to descend with our name on it. But before we look for that, the question that I found myself asking of me is, how are you doing with what you already know? Maybe the better question is, when you look at your life, are you choosing a pattern of surrender to God? Or are you, like so many of us, still vying for control? Maybe a different way to put this is, what are the things that you fear the most? Because often the things that you fear the most reflects the areas that you trust God the least. And so I have found myself asking, what is it that I'm most afraid of, and what does that reflect in my life? What areas have I been unwilling to surrender to God? It could be with your relationship with a significant other. Maybe you've been burned before and now your relationship is one built not on trust but on control. Maybe it's your image. Perhaps for too long people have thought that everything is okay for you and with you, but it's just not okay. But you long for people to think that you have it together, that you're killing it. Maybe it's your future. Maybe you're a bit like me and you have a picture of how life would be in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. Perhaps the idea of not knowing where you'll be and what your life will look like terrifies you. Maybe it's your kids. Parents, I know this is a challenge. It might be the hardest thing you'll ever have to face. Perhaps the thing that scares you the most is wondering how your children will turn out, wondering if you're parenting them right, afraid of where they'll go to school and the mate that they'll choose and the life that they'll live. What are you most afraid of? That might just show you where you trust God the least. Because too often the desire for control is rooted in a lack of faith. But to reach out to Jesus, we have to relinquish control. The thing that we hold on to the most tightly will also be the thing that will pull us away from God. When we insist on holding the pen that writes the story of our lives, we refuse to let God have the final word. But when we release a clenched fist, when we open our hands to God, we open ourselves to the story that God writes for us. And yeah, on the surface, that is terrifying. But the message of the angel that was given both to Mary and to Joseph, in fact, it is the number one command given to any follower of God throughout the scriptures. We are told, do not be afraid. Joseph opted to open his clenched fist. Matthew tells us when Joseph woke up, he did as the angel of the Lord commanded and took Mary as his wife, but he did not have sexual relations with her until her son was born, and Joseph named him Jesus. What is interesting to note, Mary wasn't the one told his name. It was Joseph. We often discount Joseph's whole role in this because he isn't the father, but there is something profound in his story that his obedience to God gave us the name that we know as the name above all names. And Joseph had to choose, would he be faithful? Because I recognize that God would have come through somehow. But Joseph chose how he would respond and what his role would look like. Either he was in or he wasn't. There was no going halfway. And today, the same is true. There is no such thing as being 87% surrendered to God. Jesus tells us there's no such thing as partly following him. He tells us it's all or nothing. There's always going to be a level of sacrifice. There's always going to be the ask for surrender. Following Jesus at all is an act of surrender. In Matthew 16, Jesus tells his followers, if any of you want to be my follower, you must give up your own way, take up your cross, and follow me. If you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it, but if you give up your life for my sake, you will find it. And what do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your soul? Is anything worth more than your soul? The story that God is writing for you and for me requires something. It demands more than some of us want to give. Some of us are willing to give. Some of us don't doubt our capacity to even start to give what it asks of us. But remember that control is an illusion. Control is like a drug that gives you a high but leaves you with a bad hangover. And it hurts you, maybe not today and maybe not tomorrow, but it will. Trust me on that. When you attempt to clench your fists in control, somebody will get hurt. But understand this. You won't and you don't always have the power to control. But it is always in your power to surrender. In the life of surrender, we come to find the life that could never be found in control. In surrender, we find the blessing of God that is absent in the life that clings to control. In surrender, we discover the only life truly worth living. Jesus invites us to be like his stepfather, Joseph, and embrace a life of surrender. It may not be the life that you dreamt of, but it's the only life worth living. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, submit to God, and he will make your paths straight. Remember, following Jesus is a continual act of surrender. So trust in him. Let him lead. He does a far better job of it than I ever could. Allow him to write your story, but to give him the ability to write means you have to give him the pen. I'm going to ask if the worship team would come back up. We're going to close with a song, rightly, of surrender. It is a song of surrender, but it's also a song of rescue. It's a song that recognizes and understands that this is not just me, this is God meeting me in that point of surrender and lifting me up. And if you're here today, perhaps you need to follow through with the words in the song that says, falling on my face and worship, giving all I am to seek your face. Maybe you need a physical act of surrender. Falling to your knees, maybe falling on your face as an act of surrender to God. But know that when you call out to him, he responds, he answers, and he lifts you up. I don't know where you're at today in this journey that we call life. Maybe you've never met this God in a real way. Maybe you've never allowed yourself to surrender him. Maybe you've been holding on for dear life, just hoping that you can maintain some illusion of control. Maybe today is the day that you make the choice to say, God, I'm letting go of the things that I try to cling to. Maybe you've been following Jesus for a long time, but you've been following at a distance, trying and hoping that if you keep him at arm's length, then you can keep the things that you maybe want to hold back from him behind your back, and he'd just see you reaching out maybe with one hand. But the invitation of Jesus is not just to those that don't know him, it's to us who have been following. He says, come to me. But if you want to follow me, you have to relinquish control and take up your cross. But know that if you lose your life for my sake, you'll find it. So I don't know what this is going to look like today. I know that coming forward in physical responses, especially at an altar, especially in front of people, can be daunting. But my hope today is that even if you don't move a muscle, and I'm hoping you do, but if you don't move a muscle, that you would embrace the life that Jesus is calling us to. This life of surrender, this life of obedience that says, I don't have control. That says, I don't have it all figured out, but what I do have is a God that cares, a God who is able, and I am choosing to live a surrendered life. Would you stand with us as we sing together?